You lend me 10 bucks, I give you 9 bucks back. That's a negative interest rate. So you can do that, or you're just going to spend the 10 bucks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 12th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin today in Frankfurt, Germany, the headquarters of the European Central Bank. Also, we're going to begin inside the Twitter feed of the President of the United States. In Congress, perhaps, but bear with me here, would you? The ECB announced a big new stimulus package this morning. It's going to start buying up bonds again, quantitative easing, you might remember that's called. And it's pushing interest rates even deeper into the negative. I'll save you the long explainer, but the bottom line is that negative rates are supposed to goose economies by making lending money and spending money more profitable, more attractive than saving money. So that's the ECB. The presidential Twitterage on this was to urge the Federal Reserve to do the same thing, negative interest rates. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino puts those two things together.
Europe's benchmark interest rate has been negative since 2014. Pushing it even lower is a dramatic effort to shore up the eurozone, says Torsten Slok, chief economist with Deutsche Bank Securities.
To essentially throw the kitchen sink at the European economy.
Europe has seen years of slow growth, but Slok says uncertainty over Brexit and global trade has made things even worse.
The trade war has been having a fairly significant impact on all countries in the world that are exporters.
Among them, Germany, the biggest economy in Europe, where a collapse in exports has the country on the brink of recession. That's a far cry from conditions in the United States.
The U.S. is in a much stronger position economically.
Jonathan Wright, an economist at Johns Hopkins, says despite fears of a slowdown, the U.S. economy is in good shape. And with interest rates above 2%, the Fed still has plenty of room to cut without going negative.
I think that that is something that for the U.S. would be an absolute last resort.
It also probably wouldn't do what Trump said in his tweets he wants it to, which is weaken the dollar to make U.S. exports more competitive. Jeffrey Cleveland is chief economist with Payden & Riegel.
The best thing that could happen for the U.S. dollar would be for the rest of the world to improve their economic growth.
In fact, after the ECB announcement, the euro dropped sharply against the dollar, but over the course of the day, it regained all that lost ground. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
The foreign exchange markets, they tell you so much. All right, moving on. One updates the trade war news at one's peril because Twitter, right? But the last we knew, talks with China are still scheduled to restart next month, and there have been some promising signs of de-escalation on both sides. But again, Twitter. Thing is that while China and the Trump administration are still at trade odds, the rest of the global economy continues apace, and there are some countries who are taking advantage of the moment, which you might call, in an admittedly oversimplified way, the winners of the trade war.
There are really two sets of countries that could gain.
That's Mary Lovely. She's an economist at Syracuse University.
One are sort of upstream suppliers, so Australia may supply more iron ore, or Brazil will provide soybeans.
Upstream?
Basic commodities or minerals.
Brazil is a great example, by the way. When China stopped buying U.S. soybeans, Brazilian soybean exports filled the gap. In 2017, Brazil had half of the Chinese soybean market. Last year, 77% of it. So that is upstream. Here again, Mary Lovely.
But then there are the further downstream parts of the supply chain where countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore come in. And these are places where workers put together things.
Say Vietnam. According to the U.S. Trade Representative, Vietnamese exports to the United States were up nearly 6% last year. A lot of that was electrical parts and clothing and shoes, all downstream products, like Mary was saying. There is a caveat here, of course. These aren't new trade relationships. We have long gotten a whole lot of downstream goods from Vietnam, and China has been buying Brazilian soybeans for a while now, too. What's changing, though, bit by bit, are the relationships and investment in these different parts of the supply chain, downstream and upstream. Take Brazil, for instance. Here's Kyle Handley. He's at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
There's plenty of large agro-industrial firms in Brazil that form new relationships with these Chinese buyers, and those relationships may be pretty sticky.
Sticky meaning, in other words, once businesses commit to their supply chain, it is not so easy to change it back. It takes time and money, which are the costs of trade war-induced uncertainty. Kyle Handley, one last time.
The United States, in the longer term, may have cast, because of this current trade war, a pretty long shadow over its trustworthiness in future international relations. And so I think that's certainly bad for the United States, but the winners might be the countries that have continued to attempt to play by the rules as best they can.
Well, let's see. The European Central Bank says the European economy is a mess. Wall Street Today, hey, look, there's progress in the trade war. It'll be the happy music when we do the numbers. There was a thing I used to do on this program a couple of years ago when inflation numbers came out, numbers that were at the time invariably soft. There just wasn't much inflation at all. So inflation, I would say, isn't really dead. It's just mostly dead. Princess Bride, by the way, watch it if you haven't. Billy Crystal, Miracle Max. Anyway, turns out I can't say that anymore because we got the latest report on consumer prices this morning, inflation by another name. The core number, that is, inflation without food and energy costs, rose 0.3% in August from a month earlier, the third straight month we've seen prices rise that much. And year over year, core inflation is up 2.4%. That's a 13-month high. All of which gets me to this, our every now and then series, Your Economic Questions, Our Answers, called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer... My brain work and blade.
Our topic today, yes, you guessed it, inflation and why, really, we kind of need it. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the answer.
Listener Jeffrey Dutton is retired, living on a fixed income, so he worries a fair amount about rising prices. And that prompted him to ask us a question that goes beyond his own pocketbook concerns to fundamental economics.
Why must our dollars lose their value over time? Wouldn't an economy without inflation make us all better off?
Dutton's in his 70s, so he remembers when runaway inflation savaged the U.S. economy and contributed to the wreckage of Jimmy Carter's presidency. Here's Carter at a press conference in 1978.
The most serious problem that our nation has is inflation, and it's getting worse.
It would soon spike to a 30-year high of 13.5%. Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute says scary stories of hyperinflation past make people fear any rise in prices today.
We are used to thinking of inflation as a problem, something we want less of.
But he says now...
The concern among economists has actually done a pretty dramatic flip to being concerned about too little inflation.
Why do economists think we need inflation at all? One standard explanation is that if prices stop rising, consumers will hold back on buying stuff, waiting to get a better deal. But Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research doesn't think consumers actually plan that way.
Suppose you're going to buy a refrigerator, and we'll just say it costs $1,000. We'll make it a really nice refrigerator. And you go, oh, wait a second. Prices are falling 0.5% a year. So if I wait 6 months, then I could save $5. I don't think that's a very realistic story.
Baker says the most compelling economic argument for inflation has to do with interest rates and the Federal Reserve.
Some amount of inflation, 2%, 3%, maybe 4%, turns out to be very beneficial because it gives the Federal Reserve more ability to boost the economy in a downturn.
Here's what Baker's talking about. To fight recession, the Fed cuts interest rates to lower the cost of borrowing money. That's supposed to encourage businesses and consumers to spend and invest more, jump-starting the economy. Now, there's a bit of complicated math here, but basically interest rates are calculated in part based on the inflation rate. If inflation's near zero, the Fed doesn't have much room to lower interest rates any further. So a moderate level of inflation gives the Fed the maneuvering room it needs. Plus, Baker says, steady, moderate inflation actually encourages businesses to expand.
If I'm a car company thinking of building a new factory, I go, oh, there's 2% inflation. Next year, I'm going to be selling cars for 2% more money. 2 years out, I'll be selling them for 4% more. So that gives me more incentive to invest.
Now, inflation, even middling inflation like we've got now, isn't good for everyone. People on a fixed income, like our listener Jeffrey Dutton, see their purchasing power slowly erode. And if wages don't rise at least as much as prices, workers lose ground and become poorer over time as well. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The thing about a listener series called I've Always Wondered is that we kind of can't do it without knowing what you are wondering. So tell us, would you? Marketplace.org is where you do that. Things that are deceptively more complicated than you might think. Same-day grocery delivery. But therein lies market share and profit, which is why Walmart's expanding its $98 a year unlimited grocery delivery fee nationwide, trying to keep up with Amazon Fresh and Instacart and all the rest of them. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
Let's say I get a craving for chicken tacos. I order the ingredients, including 1 pound of raw chicken, to be delivered to my house today. Think about what goes into that. The company has to pay someone to shop for me. It has to keep the raw chicken cold while it sits outside my apartment for hours. And since I want it today, it'll be hard to lump my order together with other deliveries. Sujarita Kadali at Forrester says that'll be expensive.
It is a lot cheaper to go to a neighborhood and deliver 5 orders at once than it is to go and deliver 1 order at a time.
The costs pile up. Joel Rampolt at Alex Partners says when it comes to grocery shopping, customers have traditionally done most of the work.
The customer has picked the product off the shelf, they've packed it themselves, they've driven it to their home, they've unloaded it into their kitchen, and you're shifting that work onto the company. And the customer expects to pay the same price.
Also, people can be really particular about what they eat. Maybe I get the shipment and the chicken is fine, but I also ordered some peaches and I don't like the looks of one of them. Charlie O'Shea is a retail analyst at Moody's.
Does the delivery person run back to the store and get another peach and bring it back to the customer? Do they get a discount?
Despite all the challenges, companies like Walmart and Amazon are investing in grocery delivery because they want customers to turn to them for everything. It's about being the most convenient option. Molly Blakeman is a spokesperson for Walmart.
Everybody needs more time on their calendar. We're offering customers a number of ways to shop that makes it easy for them.
Walmart does have an advantage here. It's the biggest grocery retailer in the country, with 4,700 stores that it can ship chicken and peaches and taco shells from. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Sometimes words do not mean what you think they mean. Exhibit A today, courtesy of the California legislature, rent control. Lawmakers here have approved a bill to cap just how high rent can rise. The governor says he'll sign it, which would make California the third state this year to pass rent control legislation. That's after Oregon and New York. And three, I think, officially makes it a trend, right? But as Marketplace's Ben Bradford explains, rent control might not actually keep rent affordable.
Legislative debate is a boring phrase, but the legislative debate yesterday in the California Assembly about passing the rent control bill was not boring.
Do the right thing, because guess what? You may know someone who will be homeless one day.
Los Angeles Assemblyman Mike Gibson was among the Democrats who argued slowing rent increases will help people stay in their apartments. California's bill caps the amount most landlords can raise rent on a tenant each year at 5% plus inflation. In Oregon's new law, it's 7% plus inflation.
Rent control is definitely having a moment.
Jim Lapides is a vice president at the National Multifamily Housing Coalition, which represents apartment owners. Lapides says policymakers are addressing a symptom, high rent, with the wrong medicine.
It's a little bit like feeding someone candy who's been starving. It tastes good and it'll make you feel full in the short term, but at the end of the day, you're only making your health worse and worse.
It's not just landlords that think this about rent control, says Mark Treskin at the left-leaning Urban Institute.
most economists generally hate it. I think it's in a lot of economics 101 books. Because if you just think about it, kind of basic supply and demand, I mean, what you're doing is you're limiting the ability to have price meet demand.
Democratic lawmakers, including Oakland Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks, acknowledged that rent control won't solve the housing crisis.
It's a false choice to say we either need to build or protect tenants. We have to do both of those things.
In the meantime, California is 3.5 million homes shy of what state housing experts project it needs. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And there's a lot of sort of inside baseball speak when you open up a traditional sewing pattern.
Disrupting DIY clothing. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 45 points today, about a 10%, 27,182. The NASDAQ rose 24 points, 0.3%, 8,194. The S&P 500 banked 8 points, about 0.2%, 3,009, 3,009. On that particular index, heard about Walmart's expansion into the grocery delivery world. Walmart stock up 0.75% today. One company's debut on the big board was less than stellar on this Thursday. Shares in the teeth alignment company Smile Direct Club swooned 27% on its first day of trading. Ouch. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.78%. It was like 3 weeks ago, right, that it was 1.4-something? You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We come now to the mea culpa part of the program, kind of self-inflicted, actually. We asked the other day what you think of when you hear the word recession, and in particular, when you hear a lot about a possible recession in the news, what do you think of that?
Hi, my name is Ian Picard, and I'm from Boca Raton, Florida. The media, I think, will see a headline, recession, and they'll want people to think of the most recent recession, because that drives viewership. And the most recent recession happens to be a very bad one that caused a lot of people to change their conditioning about how to act in the financial world. So keep people scared and they'll keep watching. And that's what the media wants.
My name is Annabelle Forey from Lakewood, Colorado. When I hear the word recession, my reaction depends upon the source. When I hear it from commercial media, whether online or TV or radio, well, they seem to be so driven to sensationalize everything that I take it all with a grain of salt. And I get upset that all of you seem to be trying to bring us down into a recession.
Hi, my name is Mitchell Bentley, and I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. If you look at some of the headlines, you'd probably think that the world was about to end. I can see why anyone would think that with the trade war, and the R word kind of acts like a cherry on top. When I hear the media saying that a recession is coming, though, I don't get that worried. I was taught that when you invest, you should do it for the long term. I think that when your investing timeline is for 10, 20, and 40 years, any fluctuations down or up will come out in the wash, and it won't last forever.
Let us know what you're thinking about, would you, when you hear the word recession here or elsewhere. Hit us up at marketplace.org. We're at Marketplace on Twitter. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl, K-A-I-R-Y-S-S-D-A-L. This next story, well, it's an interview, actually, is proof once again, if we still needed it, that any industry is ripe for disruption. Eyeglasses, razor blades, taxis. Also, sewing. And if you're thinking breaking out the old sewing machine at home, a paper pattern laid out on the table, pieces of cut-up fabric all over the place, Zoe Washington would like to disabuse you of that notion. She's a fashion journalist, also the founder of Sew Squad, S-E-W-S-Q-U-A-D, Sew Squad. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been a fashion journalist for a while, right? Like 10-something years?
I have. I've been in fashion since the year 2000. I started at Cosmopolitan magazine and then quickly went up the Hearst ladder and have been in fashion ever since. I made the transition over to digital media about 3 years ago when I was the fashion director at Brit & Co.
Okay, so what is it that you saw in your experience that made you say, you know what, there is a business model to be had in sewing patterns and people producing their own stuff?
You know, I mean, like most people in fashion, I was really enamored with the idea of sewing at a young age. And when I was a teenager, I would often go to traditional sort of craft stores, the Michaels, the Joann Fabrics, and I wouldn't see much, you know, in the aisles that looked like me, that reflected me. And so I was sort of surprised, you know, as I've been going through fashion as an editor and writer and stylist, that that had not been addressed. And I really think that there's just such a dearth of product out there for teenagers and tweens. And what we want to do is really take that same sense of curiosity and excitement about style and translate it to something that's a little bit more traditional, and vice versa. Take the traditional idea of sewing and bring it into the digital era.
Right. And give them something to wear when they're Instagramming all the time, right? Fundamental.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean,
you know, it's a little crossover. All right. So look, so you sent us some stuff. It's a package with the branding up on top that says Sew Squad, and it is create your own classic tee, super simple sewing project, no machine necessary. I'm going to open it up.
I love it.
And I want to talk what we're going through here. So
it's
just
happening in real time.
In real time. As I do this, you know, I remember my mom when I was a kid, she would get sewing patterns like on that flimsy tissue material, and she'd lay it out on the dining room table and pin it to fabric. And she's probably listening to this, so she will certainly correct me in a phone call as soon as she hears it. But I don't recall her ever wearing anything that she made. But that's, I guess, that's my mom. That's not this. All right. So here's the fabric and the paper, convenient tape measure. And is the basic idea still the same? I mean, you supply the fabric, you lay it out, and you clip and sew. Is that the deal?
Yeah, the basic idea is still the same. It's really just a new interpretation of it. You know, it's really difficult if you ever went past just watching your mom make clothes.
I don't think I did. But anyway.
You missed out. But, you know, sometimes when they can be intimidating, and the barrier to entry to trying out your own sewing seems really high because it's very confusing. There's, you know, sometimes they're in French and there's multiple sizing, and there's a lot of sort of inside baseball speak when you open up a traditional sewing pattern. And so what we wanted to do is to really take a lot of the things that I learned as an editor and as a stylist and fashion writer, which is to be very direct, to be very visual, to be dynamic, and to show how you can style some of the clothes that you make, and simplify some of these ideas into something that's very easy to use and fun to wear, and that you can create, depending on your skill level, rather quickly. And even if it takes you a while, it's just a simple thing that you can pair into your outfit.
So this is great, actually, and you were not kidding you were talking, you know, fundamentals and everything, because item one on one of these sheets I have in front of me now is how to thread a needle. Step one, get a sewing needle, right?
Oh, yes.
I mean, you know.
The 101s are very important,
for sure.
And that's something that we really learned working with a lot of young teens and tweens, which is, again, if we are going to say we're beginner friendly, we have to be beginner friendly. And you'd be surprised how many people, adults included, have never really tried sewing because they didn't quite know how to thread a needle.
Totally. So who makes the fashion and styling decision that you then put into these envelopes and send out to your, subscribers, right? Or you put them on the shelf at Joann? I mean, how do I get one of these things?
You can go straight to sewsquad.com. Okay. We sell them right now on our site, and we do new drops every season or so. And I'm lucky enough to be somebody who goes to market appointments and is able to see what designers are making 6 months ahead of time. I know what's
right,
coming.
Right.
You know, and what we like to do is take all of that and think to ourselves, okay, what could our customer make on their own? What would they want to make? What silhouette would they find very wearable and very interesting, but maybe they just haven't figured out how to use it yet?
For sure. So about you and this business, are you going to now leave fashion style journalism and be an entrepreneur? I mean, what's the plan?
Well, you know, I mean, I there's a lot of things that are ahead of us goes, here, right? Kai. I mean, yeah. If we want to get in deep, yeah, that'd be great. It depends on how successful this segment goes. Mm-hmm. you know, I would
look,
love...
Look, we got you on the air.
Exactly. I would love that. You know, my passion is with style and fashion and discovering your own sense of self through the art of fashion. But So Squad is definitely my number one goal, and I am really excited for it because I think it really fills a gap that has yet to be addressed in this market.
Zoe Washington, company called So Squad. In her spare time, I guess she does this while she's not doing fashion journalism. Zoe, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is one of those where visuals help. Check out that kit we were talking about, me and Zoe, at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of, why no, Kai? I can't imagine what could possibly go wrong. Saw this on CNBC. Amazon, purveyor of the Echo Smart Assistant in all its forms. Definitely not using the name here because I did that once and got into all kinds of trouble. Anyway, Amazon's going to start letting regular people provide answers for questions it doesn't know the answer to. Regular people. Yes, there will be safeguards and humans to keep an eye on the algorithms that will choose what the thing says. But come on, right? And we are out of here. Dow Industrial is up 45 points today, about a 10th percent. The NASDAQ rose 24 points, 3/10 percent. The S&P 500, 8 points to the good, 2/10 percent. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bikella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.